Is it art or craft? Our guest today has come to the conclusion that this is really a moot question. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Krissa Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program devoted to exploring the visual arts. Co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce it at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Our guest today is Stephanie Wilbanks. She is a recent transplant from Arizona and currently lives in Paso Robles. Much of Stephanie's life has been spent in the world of music, her voice being her instrument. Not too long before she moved here, she discovered fused glass. She took a few classes and fell in love. With this new visual art interest, she found a home pretty quickly here on the Central Coast, both with the Paso Robles Art Association and with Studios on the Park in Paso. This is going to be her second year of participating in the Arts Obispo Open Studio Art Tour, which takes place in October. As we did last week, we'll give you that information at the end of the program. Now it's time to hear from Stephanie. Stephen and I joined her at her studio in Paso. Stephanie Wilbanks, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Well, it's our pleasure. Stephanie, you work mostly with fused glass?
I do. Kiln form glass, and so that I use the kiln to put the different layers of glass together until I'm happy with it.
When did you find yourself in life getting interested in creating things?
My path to glass was varied. I started actually in music. My undergrad was in music, spent most of my time in choirs and groups, and took art history lessons, took a jewelry class. I got into the fiber art, made the big circles almost, loved that, put it on everyone's walls, and then had to get out of that because everyone had too much of it. I always loved blown glass. I was always fascinated to go to studios and see blown glass, could sit for hours and watch glass blowing, but you know, knew that would be too big for me to do except for maybe an experiment once. And then someone told me about fused glass. You can work cold. You can work in two dimensions, then heat it up. So I got excited, took a class, and I was hooked. And that was about 8 years ago.
I taught alongside George Jurcich, a glass blower, and then he was getting involved with the fused glass and able to teach that as an alternative to the glass blowing. It was fascinating to watch. I took a couple of classes, too, just to see. So I have some pieces hidden around someplace. We haven't talked to somebody doing fused glass for a while, so let's get back a little bit into some of your actual process.
Okay. I work two dimensions. I work cold. I have to always think about the physics and the chemistry of the glass. So the glass naturally goes to about a quarter of an inch, which is two pieces of the kind of glass that most manufacturers sell. So I work in those two dimensions with those two pieces, and the first thing I think of is color. Choose my colors, start cutting, work in two dimensions, put it in the kiln the first time. For my glass, about 1480 degrees. So now I have a flat piece. Then I go back and put other pieces on top of it. And that's the art. That's the magic to me. That's the fun part of it. Put that back in the kiln for what they call tack fusing to about 1350 degrees. Then I have a piece either to be a display piece, it's flat, or if it's going to be a useful piece, then I go back and put it in a mold, put it back in the kiln to about 1250 degrees, and then that mold will shape it into whatever bowl or plate or whatever I had in mind. So it takes at least 3 days, plus however long it takes me to assemble the glass cold.
That last step, that's called slumping?
Correct.
So if we imagine a sheet of glass sitting on top of a shallow bowl, and then when it gets warm, it sags.
Exactly. And one thing I didn't mention is one learns pretty quickly the cycles of glass, and that you take it to a certain temperature, let it sit a while so that all bubbles go out. They call it bubble soak. Take it to the next level, and it'll fuse together. But then you have to take it back down very slowly to it at the glass I use, 900 degrees, let that sit for an hour to anneal it, and then slowly cool it down. If you don't do that, the piece could crack either as soon as you take it out of the kiln or a week or two, a month later. But you have to kind of know your process and know how quickly to take it up and how slowly to take it back down.
Did you learn this through experience, or was this something that you learned in a class?
Both. When I first started taking classes, they did the kiln. You finished the piece, you came back next week, and magic, it was all done. But then you started learning, especially once you tack fused, what would round and what would fuse into it. But it wasn't until I had my own kiln that I learned this the hard way from mistakes, and still mistakes to this day. Sometimes the mistakes are happy accidents, mm-hmm. and something kind of cool will come out of it. I had a bubble recently that I couldn't tell you why it happened, but it just, the combination of things made it kind of a nice looking piece. The piece sold, and it was an accident.
How many layers do you get sometimes?
I think the most I've worked in is about 4 layers. It's guaranteed 3 times, possibly even more, but usually 4 layers is about as thick as I've worked.
This is all the same type of glass. Compatibility is an issue, as I understand it.
Compatibility is very important. So what I do is make sure I buy everything from the same company. Then I don't have to worry about it. They've already made it compatible. They just heat up and cool down at different temperatures and at different speeds, I think it is actually. And so that they never completely coalesce and then they crack.
Metalsmiths haven't got quite that coefficient issue going on, but we certainly have melting temperatures. You get something really low temperature melting on top of something that you're heating up much higher than that, and it just pits right into it. So there are people who set up studios, so they're working in maybe aluminum and silver, but they've separated the tools and everything else so that they can try to make it work.
Yeah, it's really difficult when you're working with metals, and of course glass is the same way, that you have to keep everything consistent. I mean, amazingly consistent.
Manufacturers actually suggest that you write it down each time, mm-hmm. so that if you have a mistake or you have a problem, you can write down why you think it happened, try the same thing again at a different temperature, that worked, say why. And sometimes it's not the temperature, sometimes it's how quickly or slowly you heat it up or cool it down that can make the difference. So writing it down is very important.
You've used the term annealing. Metal people use that too. The definition, I believe, is how do I get the stress out of this material, not whether it's heat reduction or heat addition. Somebody came up with anneal at the altar of creativity.
Oh, I remember that. Because if you don't, your piece doesn't work.
So I'm looking around the room here, because we're in your studio, and a lot of what I'm seeing, we could call them small paintings in the sense that they're being displayed as flat pieces on stands, and then there are some slump pieces also. But is the flat surface right now the favorite?
I've been doing both, and I think it comes from the art versus craft, which you and I've talked about before. When I first started this, every piece I did was a bowl or a dish, and I gave it away. And then when I moved to Paso and started getting involved at Studios in the Park and the Paso Robles Art Association, then I needed art. And so I decided at that point that art was something that could be displayed but not used. We could spend hours just on that subject, I'm sure. But in my own mind, in my own development, if it was flat and on a stand, then it was art. So for themed shows, I still think that way. And that's where some of the figural things come. I don't know what would have ever made me do a vineyard, except that that was the theme of the show. So if I wanted to be in there, I had to figure out a way. The double positive to that for me has been that I try a technique maybe that I've never tried. So I use that technique, learn something about it, maybe fail, maybe do it twice or something, and then end up with a piece that works with the theme. The more functional pieces, I've kind of settled into Studios in the Park. I'm an associate artist there. And those pieces tend to go into the gift shop because people there tend to think of it as more something useful. And, you know, I don't know what happens when it goes to their home. But, and some of the art pieces have sold there, too. In the meantime, through this whole process, I think I've gone full circle, and now I don't care. If I'm pleased with it and it thrills me that someone is pleased with it enough to want to own it, then I don't care if they consider it art or a craft. Mm-hmm. But it took me a while to come to that.
I think that's true of all artists. I think when we start out in the creative process, we think of our pieces more as children, you know, type of thing, and you're afraid to see them go. And then after a while, it's like, no, that's a good thing. It's a good thing when somebody else wants it, and that's okay. It can go away now.
I think often kind of terminology comes in terms of, oh, that's really cute, and that adjective usually doesn't get applied to artwork.
And it's kind of like, ugh, stabbed in the heart there. Okay, now I've got to...
Yeah, cute's a hard word.
Yeah.
But as you were saying, getting to that place, if cute is what is meaningful to somebody, then, hey, I will know that it wasn't cute when I was making it.
Not the adjective I would have chosen.
No. But I also, in my own response to things, I don't think it's as much about cute, but it can often be about humor. That's that I
true.
Can be attracted to.
That's true. Some of the exhibits I've seen recently, the humor is what draws you, and then you begin to see the technique.
I've noticed that you're working both in a circular and a rectangular format. Do you ever go outside of that? Different shapes?
I've done a couple of things, but no, not so much. I think I tend, and I'm learning this about other artists, tend to work in series, so I get involved in one shape or start thinking about one slumping mold. Well, there's a couple of molds. You can start with the square, and then by the time that they go down into the mold, it's more like a bowl. Mm-hmm. But I haven't worked too much outside of a formal shape yet. Maybe my next series.
Well, there's also something about glass, and it's certainly easier to cut straight lines.
That's true. I'm getting better at my cutting skills for circles, but the straight lines are the easier, and also the easier to put together, because color is the most important thing to me. If you put two colors together and they don't match almost perfectly, and then you slump it, you get the, usually use a clear base. Mm-hmm. You get the clear base showing in between. So unless it's what you intend, it's easier to work in nice, sharp, straight lines, because it'll fuse better. Sometimes I'll add things, though, in shape that aren't straight lines. So maybe I do more of my non-square in the layering, in the tack fusing.
You pointed out, you know, the vineyard. What I'm seeing there is also just a different exploration of texture. And is that also using different types of glass, you know, like broken pieces that you buy, or are you cutting all of those up?
And... It depends. Both use both techniques. The one in the vineyard over there, those are rods, and they come as long pieces. Some of them come as stringers. They're almost like spaghetti. You can get frit, which is four different sizes, a very coarse, a fine, a medium, and a super, almost a powder. But you'd have to have so many for all the colors that I've been able to use. So I finally learned to use a coffee grinder, and I break it up myself. And then sometimes, like that one, I make lots and lots of tiny little squares. And that may either be the background, or in that case, the grass and the trees. But sometimes, too, that's just a dividing line between the two colors to tie the two together.
And it's interesting, too, with the glass, you can say cutting up a lot of squares, and we're sitting 6-7 feet from this piece, the softening in the melting, fusing process makes them look much more like little pebbles.
And you do have to plan for that. And the different temperatures I was talking about earlier, you can tack fuse at different temperatures and slump at different temperatures, paying attention in your mind how much you want the edges to soften.
Way back when, did a little bit of enameling, which is glass melted onto the surface of metal. And it's the type of thing that technically you can do pretty quickly. And then it's often about 15 or 20 years of dedicated exploration before an enamelist really can confidently say, I know pretty much now what this is going to do. You know, it's just this endless process. And they tend to be very solitary folk that go into enameling.
I have so much glass and so many different colors. You get excited about it and you want the newest kind. And the irid textures that have that metallic finish to them. Translucent, transparent. The light, how the light hits them is very important to me. And, well, that's important to glass. That's one of the functions of the beauty of glass. It's kind of never-ending. You always want to try the newest thing.
You're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Our guest today is Stephanie Wilbanks, who works with fused glass and has her home and studio in Paso Robles. We continue now with her description of visiting a glass production factory.
I went to the glass factory and watched how they manufacture it. It was amazing. That you go all the way back to the huge kilns or the glory holes like they do in the blown glass, then lay it out on a slab and just roll it out. And then as we walk through, they describe the different colors. Some things like inks and purples have certain metals in them that cause all kinds of problems for them and make it a lot more expensive to make. And then blacks, for whatever reason, are really soft and they melt faster. So if you have a very black piece, you use slightly lower temperature or keep it there a little less. You have to learn some of those kinds of things too.
So how does a piece start for you? You walk into the studio and nothing's on the workbench at that point. What happens?
Usually it's a color. Then I guess I start thinking about if it's for a show, then I think about the theme. And if it's for the gift shop, then I think, well, what's the season coming up? What might appeal? You know, is it holiday time or is it or springtime? Bright colors maybe would appeal more. So color first, then technique, and then size, I think. And then sometimes I'll start and think I have an idea, think I know exactly what I'm doing and it doesn't work. And I just put it away and do something really simple and think about it. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, one morning, I'm like, that's it. That'll work. That'll fix it. And then I come do it. And then there's others that I'm just working on because it's that theme, so I've got to do it. And I don't know, you know, I'm not so sure about putting a figure in it. That's not really what I do. And then it comes together very easily. I don't know why that.
I think we're all in this together.
Yeah.
So 4 in the morning, eh?
Well, I don't think I'm awake in particular. I think your mind's just working on things.
I used to call them midnight epiphanies. You're sound asleep, and all of a sudden the solutions slowly start coming to you. I'm rarely conscious when they happen, but I remember them in the morning.
When something doesn't work, I guess I'm thinking about the salvageability in terms of material or in terms of just that mental, dang, this all goes in the trash. What area do you have to kind of say, okay, I can redirect this?
There's one thing that happens in glass called de-vit or de-vitrification, which it gets to a certain temperature, it starts to crystallize on the top, and it almost looks like fingerprints. So it's unacceptable for selling a piece, certainly. And if once you get de-vit, there's nothing you can do but sandblast it off or put another top on it. I call it my glass hospital. I have a sandblaster. Blast it off, and then you can just put it back in, and they call it fire polish it. Do that sometimes. Sometimes with the bubble, it's just a happy accident, and I accept it. Sometimes I'll cut it up and try and use it in another piece. But usually if it's cracked, I can't save it. But I've probably only actually thrown away 5 or 6 pieces. There's usually something you can do with it, even if it's using a smaller corner of it or a section of it as the art centerpiece of another piece. Usually with glass, I guess because you can refuse it, maybe that's why it's a little more flexible than other media. And then I also keep smaller pieces, all the little bits. So I start with the great big pieces of glass, which could be even 24 by 24. Start cutting that down. Then little bits, I divide it all by color. So I have bins of color. Then I have little tiny things. Then those become my frit. Glass is very expensive, so you use it all. And that's the beauty of it again. You can, because you're melting it. Putting things in the kiln for others and how it could be ruined worries me too much. Their pieces don't come out like they think, and then they're disappointed. I don't want to be part of that disappointment.
You're removed from an absolute vital process of the learning curve.
Yes, the complete process that's important to learn. I mean, cutting out parts of it doesn't really help you very much.
We were talking about stretching canvases the other day, and it was just, again, that sense, if you've never learned how, then that limits, mm-hmm. obviously, kind of what shape and size you can begin to paint on.
Also, I think it's important from what you've been discussing, the two of you, is the fact of the science that's involved in the creative process. And there's an awful lot of it in many of the different media that you have to know your stuff. You have to know the technical parts of it in order to be successful.
And also coming to understand, how do the eyes tell you what you're about to do? How do your ears clue you in as to what isn't working or what is working? You're using sound when you're cutting glass, right?
You do when you cut it. If it doesn't have a certain sound, you know you haven't cut it cleanly, and it's not going to break cleanly. If you cut it clean enough, you can break it with your hands. Yeah, you definitely use sound with it because you would not start it deep enough or start it too deep if you don't listen.
Is there much sound in painting except plopping on the floor?
Not a heck of a lot, but I'm a retired pastry chef, and when I used to teach classes in that, I would always explain to people that there are sounds as you're cooking that are really, really important, and they tell you what's happening. And you don't even have to look at what's going on. I think it's really important to understand that all creative processes involve all the senses. It's not just sight.
And even back to music, they say in general that you have to know the rules before you can break them. Mm-hmm. And that's probably true in all of the processes we're talking about, because later I don't have to think about those parts anymore, but you learned them somehow, and that's part of that, of the rules, so that then you can break them.
How does that music background play in how you think about shape or form, or does it?
I think it helps with balance. I think most musicians have a very organized mind. Many musicians are also engineers, right brain, left brain, but are more balanced for that reason, because you're thinking in terms of sound waves and line and finishing and timing, or even tempo, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been very helpful. And then my background in marketing, the same thing. It's very important that photos and the copy are pleasing, and that you write enough words or not too many words, and that the photos are the right size.
Shifting gears just a little bit, but you are going to be part of Open Studios this year.
I am.
And how often have you done that?
Last year was my first year, and I'm not actually going to do it in the studio. Janice Pluma asked me if I would come and be in her studio. She said, we've learned if we have more than one artist and more than one medium, people will stop because they can see several at once. It was such great fun. She asked me again this year, and I said, oh, absolutely. I would rather do that than be in my studio.
I have now had more than myself at my studio the last couple of years, and it just makes it more fun.
Yeah, it's my 12th or 13th year for Open Studios. You're kind of on stage for the 4 days that it's on, and to me it's a great deal of fun.
And the other thing we kind of found out is at first when people walked in, because there were four of us, we didn't want to descend upon them. So we kind of stood back and took turns, and one would introduce all four, who we were and which were our art, and then step back, and then the person would walk toward whatever appealed to them. They might walk by all of them, but then they would walk toward the one, and then that artist would go. And that seemed to work a little better in not having them feel overwhelmed that there were so many of us in one place.
I think there's just some of that learning curve. What do I enjoy when I walk in the store? I like to be greeted, but I usually don't like to be hounded. And so if there's a way to make somebody feel comfortable, and yet knowing that you don't have to be watching their every look. Oh, you like that one? Well, it's only $9.95 today. And we've certainly been trying to emphasize the fun of being in studios and the learning curve for all of us, helping to try to tell people what we're doing, why we're doing it, and for people to ask those questions back. So,
and I think that is what Open Studios is about. That's what I learned, is you may sell some pieces, or people may come by and buy your pieces later, but they want to know why you did it or how you did it, especially the glass. I get a lot of questions about that. I guess people don't have a chance to ask about glass maybe as much as they do about painting. So I learned kind of what they were interested in. I think this year might even bring some pieces partially done, maybe cut but not fused or something, because I don't think I anticipated that level of interest.
Oh, I think that's really a vital kind of part, because explaining it verbally over and over and over, and you see this glazed look. So being able to have a one or two step sequence, oh, got it, sort of.
I think people love to learn about the process. I mean, people who are not openly creative, although I think everybody is to some sense, but I think people who are not like glass artists, they love to see the process, you know, how you do things, where it starts, where it goes, how do you know when it's done, which is a huge problem for all of us, is stop, it's finished.
Someone else has to tell you that,
yeah.
Right?
Sometimes that's absolutely the case. We've also been saying that sometimes that interest in owning something comes because there's a story behind it.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. People would stop, especially with Janice, because she does series, but a lot of it's based on travel. So where were you? What were you thinking? And then the piece she was working on at the time, she'd added rocks and metal to. Well, why would you add rocks and metal? And in this case, it was a piece about the earth and a piece about the drought. And so she could explain, well, you know, the roots going down to get the water that they need. And people love that, because then they know the story behind it and it means more to them.
Well, my fun traveling in Europe and sidewalk artists, I had a nice conversation with that person. And so you're sometimes just buying a piece for the memory of that, as opposed to it being just the most exciting thing that you've ever seen.
But you probably still chose the one you really loved, though.
Oh, I think so. But
but you bought it because you enjoyed them. You felt a connection.
Absolutely.
I guess not. I want to make sure I mention studios, because they've been very supportive. Everyone in this county is very supportive, mm-hmm. considering I'm new to the arts and new to this area. studios on the park and the Arts Association become my family. And then I had the piece where I met you in Sloma at Dimensions, the craft show, the open studios. Everyone has just been very inclusive and very, very warm, and I've loved it. It's been great.
This is an amazing area, not only just for the quantity of people who are finding ways to be creative, but the number of grassroots organizations since the 40s that have popped up and have survived because people have a passion.
They're willing to share that, and they're willing to support you and yours. I've seen, I don't know if I've seen no jealousy or no negativity. I'm sure there is some, but I just don't see it. I see support, and maybe especially in the Art Association where there's so many mediums, and I hear there is sometimes talk by some to say, well, they're not of paintings. That's what I think of in the Art mm-hmm. Association, but there's glass, and there's sculpture, and there's wood, and there's photography, and that it's all art. And I think that's been really good. It's been especially good for visitors if I docent or if a kid comes in. Well, that's just a picture. Yes, but it's still art, because the photographers and artists had to choose what to shoot and what angle to shoot from, and you know, you can see the light going on in their head. It's very supportive of all kinds of arts. The whole county has been.
Really fortunate, and as you say, it very frequently, certainly in my case, and probably in Stephen's, but these places provide homes away from home. They provide networking, not just in terms of how do I get my art out there or something, but just people that become very good friends, and that's been an essential part of my, dare I say, 40 years now in this county. And I can't imagine it not being here. Well, Stephanie, neither of us will be able to come to your studio, nor you to ours in this case, but we wish you the very best.
Thank you. Thank you. Enjoy your open studios as well.
We will, and thank you again.
Thanks for coming up.
You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Our guest today has been Stephanie Wilbanks, an artist who creates with glass. Stephanie will be participating in the Open Studios Art Tour, which takes place October 8th, October 9th, the 15th, the 16th, each of the 4 days from 10 until 5. For information about any of the close to 200 artists, as well as how to find them, can be found at artsopispo.org. This is a free event, and the catalogs, which are also free, will be available starting next week. Check with Arts Obispo to find out where you can pick one up. Arts Obispo is the local affiliate for the California Arts Council. That group will be holding its annual business meeting here in San Luis Obispo on September 22nd. Again, information about this event, which is open to the public, can be found at Arts Obispo. Also, on September 24th, the Morro Bay Surfboard Art Festival will have its unveiling at 5 p.m. at Forever Stoked Gallery on Quintana Road. Stephen and I will be airing an interview with two of the coordinators of that program. There are many activities connected with the Surfboard Festival. You can learn about those at mbsaf.com. We will meet up with you again in October with a program about an art exhibit that takes place in Los Osos. Until then, this is Chrissy Hewitt, and on behalf of Stephen DeLuque, want to thank you so much for listening to Ears on Art, a program produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio.